Welcome to Quinn's Empowerment Hour on the BBS Radio Network, hosted by Quinn Leigh Erickson, psychotherapist, life coach, and inspirational speaker. Quinn's experience as a blind woman, a boat person from Vietnam, and a refugee has driven her to realize her dream to help you to become the best that you can be. So join Quinn every other Saturday, 9 p.m. Pacific Time, for an hour of insight and inspiration for your heart, your spirit, and your soul. Good evening. This is Quinn's Empowerment Hour with Quinn Leigh Erickson. Thank you very much for joining me tonight. Tonight, we're going to have a very special and inspiring show. I'm very excited to introduce to you a special guest on our show tonight, Christine Ha, who is the MasterChef winner in 2012. Christine has a very incredible journey, and I'm very excited to share her story with you. Christine's first cookbook is the New York Times bestseller, Recipes from My Home Kitchen, American and Asian Comfort Food. To learn more about her book and other projects that Christine Ha is involved in, go to her website, theblindcook.com. That is theblindcook.com. And here is a sneak preview about our guest, followed by an interview with Christine Ha.
The winner of MasterChef. Congratulations. Christine!
I just can't believe it. I'm the MasterChef.
This has been the most amazing experience, seriously.
After all the obstacles I've been through, going up against such awesome, amazing cooks.
So hi, Christine. Thank you very much for coming on to my show today. I really appreciate your time.
Of course, it's my pleasure.
Christine, today I'm really hoping to, you know, ask you questions about your personal journey, not just you as a MasterChef winner, because I really feel that, you know, you have an incredible story, even prior to winning the MasterChef. I'm also very excited because I'm Vietnamese like you, and I'm also blind like you as well. And I think we are kind of similar age.
Yeah, that's pretty rare that I think I come across that situation. So I'm looking forward to the kind of conversation that we'll be having.
I've lost my sight at the age of 2, so I don't have the experience of having sight. I'm just interested in learning about that process of your sight loss. When did you realize that you were starting to lose your sight?
I was 20 years old. I was in college. It was summer, and I was doing an internship in finance. That was my major in undergraduate college. And I noticed one day while I was at my job that my vision went blurry in one of my eyes. I went home and I thought it was my contact lens. So I took it out. I cleaned it, put it back in. My eye was still blurry. I threw it away and put in a new one because I had disposable contacts and it was still blurry. So I went to an eye doctor and he said it wasn't my eye. It was probably something neurological because they did all these tests on my eyes and my eyes seemed fine, but he couldn't figure out why I couldn't see out of my right eye. So I went to a neuro-ophthalmologist, and that's when the battery of tests began, blood work, lumbar punctures, all sorts of lab tests and different exams just to try to figure out what was wrong with me or what was happening to my vision. And it started with that when I was 20, and I was diagnosed several years later with multiple sclerosis when my leg went numb. But that was still a wrong diagnosis because even though I was put on the medication for MS, I still kept getting exacerbations that were worsening my vision and paralyzing me from time to time, literally. My worst attack was when, from the neck down, I was paralyzed because I had a huge spinal inflammation, and I was hospitalized, and it took 9 months of physical and occupational therapy for me to be able to regain use of my arms and hands and feet and legs. And they finally correctly diagnosed me with neuromyelitis optica, or NMO, which is similar to MS in that it's an autoimmune condition that affects the neurological system, except it's a rarer form and it tends to be more progressive, and it affects both sides of your body instead of MS, which usually affects unilaterally, so just one eye or the other. But with NMO, it's it tends to affect both sides, and it's more with the optic nerves and the spine, and MS, it also includes the brain, which was why they couldn't detect MS officially, because all the MRIs of my brain did not show any detection of MS.
So that must be quite scary that your sight was affected, but also your lower body, even you said up to your neck being paralyzed.
Right. It was scary. I think that was probably one of the darkest times of my life, was when I had that spinal inflammation. And over a matter of 3 or 4 days, I became completely paralyzed from my neck down. And so my brain was still working like an adult's, but I felt like I was trapped inside an infant's body, where I couldn't, as much as I willed for my hand to do something, I couldn't move it. I couldn't sit up by myself. I couldn't hold myself up. I couldn't walk, sit up, hold a pencil, feed myself. And then even during those months when I was recovering, it was a slow process. And even during those months, my vision would also go in and out. So there were times when I had no vision and I couldn't move. And so, but I could still talk and I could still think. So imagine how bored I was, just able to only lie there and have conversations. And I couldn't watch TV, couldn't read. I mean, what saved me through that time was actually just my friends and family that visited to carry conversations and to feed me and bathe me, and audiobooks actually were my salvation during that time.
So you really experienced a lot of helplessness.
Yes, that's very true. And I think in hindsight, I look back at it now, and I think in some ways it's, I felt like I needed that kick in the butt to learn to be helpless, because I think I was, had so much pride about being independent. I felt like I had to grow up fast because my mom died when I was young, and I was an only child, so I grew up fast, and I learned to be independent. I didn't want to depend on anybody because I figured, well, you're just going to lose that person. So that kind of, I was in this mindset, and I think it wasn't until I experienced this whole health thing in my 20s that I learned that it's okay to depend on other people. And yeah, life can be fleeting, but we can't take all the burdens on our shoulders by ourselves. And I think it's helpful to surround yourself with a good support network of friends and family and community. And that's what really helped me through it.
Who were closest to you at the time? Who supported you then?
I would say I had really good friends. I'm an only child for most of my life. After my mother died, my father did remarry. So I do have sisters from that, but they're a lot younger than me. But I grew up mostly as an only child. And so in my 20s, I was mostly close with my friends, and I had just really, really good friends. I was starting to go to this particular church, and I was close to the pastor there, and he helped me with a lot of stuff as well, like helped take me to doctor's appointments. And I started dating my now husband, and so he was around for some of that as well. So I just had a really good support network.
Yeah. You met him during your worst times.
I did. I met him after I had that very bad attack. That was before I met him, but I met him when I still had some vision. I was walking just fine, and I had regained use of my body. I had lost some of my vision permanently, so I was no longer driving, but I was still able to walk around independently. I could see the curbs, the sidewalk, the cracks in the sidewalk. I could still use my computer as long as I enlarged the font by a lot. I met him around that time, and he did experience some of the attacks that I went through after that, where my vision decreased until the level it is now. He's seen me go through more spinal inflammation, where I had trouble walking, He's flown with me to the Mayo Clinic in Arizona to see a specialist there on NMO to seek treatment. And so he's been through a lot of it.
That's really meaningful, isn't it? That to be with someone who has gone through bad times with you, but also being able to celebrate the success that you have now.
Yeah, it's very true. I think what I appreciate most about John, my husband, is that he treats me kind of the same regardless of what's kind of happening in life. I mean, yes, when I'm sick or not feeling well, he will care for me. You know, he'll be available and be more sensitive. And when I succeeded with MasterChef, when I won, he was very happy and proud of me. But he didn't really see me as a different person. He just saw it as like, this is Christine experiencing different things in life. And he didn't treat me any differently, really. He still gives me a hard time and jokes around a lot and makes fun of me. And you know, we laugh a lot together, which is what I think is important, because life is pretty hard. And I think you really have to learn to laugh at yourself and laugh at life to survive it. And what I appreciate is that no matter what I've been through, whether it's the ups or the downs, our relationship has been strong, and he's treated me the same. He doesn't see me as any differently, like any, he doesn't look at me as the master chef, and he doesn't look at me as a sickly person. He just looks at me for who I am.
At the time when you were going through the rehabilitation process, what were some of the fears you had?
I think the obvious fear I had was, how am I going to survive the rest of my life with this new baseline? So losing my vision, I thought, okay, well, what am I going to do now that I can't drive anymore? And then when I lost more vision and I had to start using a cane to get around or guide or a sighted guide, I thought, well, how am I going to make food for myself again? So every time there was just a new attack where my vision would worsen or I would have issues with my spinal cord, I just thought, well, what if this is the new baseline? How am I going to make it through life? Or how am I going to live my life the same? And the answer is, life won't be the same, but there are ways to get around it. And there just are new adaptations that you need to take to keep moving forward in life. And there are new appreciations and new gifts for things that you didn't think you had before. So I think that's an important lesson for me, was the fear of the unknown, definitely, and just not knowing what life will be like tomorrow or a week from now or 5 or 10 years from now.
How is that fear now? Do you feel like not sure whether the condition will get worse or anything like that?
Fortunately, I've been attack-free for several years. Ever since I've been on the treatment that I'm on right now, I haven't had a very serious flare-up since, I want to say, 2007. So it's been about 8 years. And so that's kind of long in the past. Of course, there's always that. The reality is, yes, it could happen at any time. Stress tends to exacerbate it. I'm surprised that having gone through MasterChef and everything that I've done the past couple of years, that I've been really fortunate not to have my health be compromised from all that stress. Whether it's bad or good, it's still stress. My life changed a lot, but I've been able to be pretty stable with my health, and I've been fortunate for that. And of course, I still think, like, yes, there's that possibility, but it's been so long that I've maybe kind of been out of touch of that paradigm. And so I don't know how it will be. I think the fear now has definitely subsided, because I've managed to show myself in the world that I'm able to succeed and live a fulfilling life in spite of these health issues that I've had, in spite of vision loss and whatnot. But the fear is still there, I think, and it will always still be there, because I remember what it was like. And I think for me right now, I'm dealing with that by working on a memoir. And that was something that I was working on when I was in grad school for creative writing. I was working on a memoir just about the experience of my being diagnosed with NMO, losing my vision, the several attacks I went through, and in parallel, the story of the year that my mother had cancer. And so I'm working on that memoir. And I think for me, that's kind of a way for me to remind myself that that fear is still real, but it's kind of a part of life, and you just learn to deal with it and process it.
So how's the memoir going? When do you expect to have that published?
That is the age-old question that my husband and my father ask me almost on a daily basis.
Oh, but, okay, so that's not good that I asked you that question. Probably more pressure.
So I'm hoping that I will be able to have a solid draft by next year. Mm. And I'll send that to my agent and, you know, work. Hopefully we'll shop it around and get it published soon after that.
Well, I'm looking forward to reading it. So you mentioned, you know, while you were losing your sight and going through that, you mentioned friends and family that kept you going. What else was in you that kept you going?
I think for one, part of it is my tenacious personality. I think I have a very determined personality, and I'm sure I get that from my parents. I mean, I'm sure, as you understand, my parents were Vietnamese refugees coming here with nothing, leaving their families behind, and virtually starting their lives from scratch here, and having a daughter, trying to make the most of their lives so that they could give me everything and allow me to have a successful life here in the U.S. So I think part of that tenacity I get from my parents. I think my mom especially was a very persevering person. She just had a very strong personality and always kind of taught me and instilled in me that you don't back down from challenges. And I think the other part that really helped me through this time was probably spirituality. Mm-hmm. I think I have a lot of faith in a higher being. And I just felt like God was, I knew that life wasn't going to be easy. And I experienced that very early on when my mom died. And I think I was never really angry through any of it. I think if anything, I just didn't understand and I was sad and confused, but I wasn't really angry and never really asked why me. Mm-hmm. I think I just felt like God had prepared me for all the moments that I encountered, and it was going to be really shitty, excuse my language. Yeah. It was going to be a really shitty experience and it was going to be hard, but I felt like through the darkest times, I would hopefully survive it. And that's not to say that there were a lot of times when I wanted to give up altogether, because I'm human and we all realize that we have our limits and we get pushed to that limit and we feel like we're at a loss and we just don't really know how to take the next step. But I think having faith that, and I think that faith of you know, knowing that God kind of has this plan for me, it was acted out by the friends and family that surrounded me, if that makes any sense. So I think God placed these people around me to help me through that time. And that was how I think my faith was empowered, by knowing these people around me. So it's sort of all interlinked, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. So I have this faith, and I think God had placed these people in my lives at the time that I needed them most. And I think that's what really helped. And I think, you know, people can say, talk all they want about faith and God and spirituality and whatever religion it is, but if they, at the end of the day, like if you're hungry and someone talks to you about God or whatever, but that person doesn't give you bread to eat, then you're going to lose that faith. So I think that it's helpful when there are, you try to make the connection between tangible things that you have in front of you in your life to that faith. And I think that's the moments that will help you move on.
It sounds like many moments in your life, you were proven again and again that there was help out there for you, whether it was on MasterChef or when you were losing your sight or when you were being paralyzed. You, over and over again, you were reminded of how much love you can receive out there and support. And then with your own independence as well, independent spirit, right? Not just receiving support. It's a combination of receiving support, but also God help those who help themselves, because you help yourself a lot. That's why people are really motivated to help you as well.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, Quinn, because I think my struggle when I was going through my health issues in my 20s was I was really upset about losing my independence. I was upset that I had to ask my friends to drive me to the grocery store. I was upset that I had to ask someone to help me read the labels on things at the grocery store. I was upset that I couldn't you know, figure out very simple things at home because I couldn't see them. And so the struggle for losing that independence, I think, was difficult for me. But what some of my friends had told me, one friend in particular, actually, it was is something I'll always remember. And she, what she said was that these people that helped me actually find joy in being able to help me and to be able to serve me.
Yes.
And I think it made me feel, I guess, less selfish, because in a way it's like, it's kind of counterintuitive to think like, okay, well, I need your help, so I'm selfish because I need someone else's time. But in actuality, I think I had to reverse that way of thinking and think, I'm being selfless because I'm giving you an opportunity to show me love, and I'm going to accept that love.
Yes.
And I think that's a hard lesson to learn. And I think a lot of people don't necessarily learn it very easily, because I think this world can also be a very cold and dark place. And I think it's not until you meet people that, I guess, defy that sort of original viewpoint and that this world is broken. I think it's not until you meet people that defy that and that you start learning to. And I think it's also about self-love. I think it's also hard for a lot of us to love ourselves, to truly love ourselves and believe that we're worth other people's time and help.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's just that balance of being interdependent, right? That you allow yourself to be helped, but also you help yourself. And,
right.
And, you know, it sounds to me like you also give a lot to the community, to people. And so for you to learn to receive, I think that's extremely healthy. You know, that's one thing that I always help my clients to understand, you know, to receive help and as they give help, because when you just give in some way, you're letting people know that they're not capable of helping you, not capable mm-hmm. enough to be there for you. Mm-hmm. You mentioned a lot about your mom, and it sounds like you had a very strong spiritual and emotional connection with her. Can you tell me a little bit about that relationship? What do you remember about her?
Yeah, my mom was a very protective parent. And because I was an only child, I think she was overprotective of me. She actually didn't allow me to help her cook in the kitchen at all.
No, you didn't learn the cooking from her?
No, I learned absolutely no cooking from her, pretty much. She didn't allow yeah. me near the knives. She didn't mm-hmm. allow me near the stove. She was always very fearful that I would hurt myself or get sick or die or whatever. So she was a very protective parent, but she put all of her energy in raising me. I think looking back on it now, I don't necessarily... This sounds kind of... maybe like I'm ungrateful, but I don't think necessarily the way she put all of herself into me was necessarily healthy for her. I think she kind of I don't want to say that it's not normal for a parent to give up everything for their child, but I think that if I could tell her now as an mm-hmm. adult, and if she were able to do it over to raise me again as a child, I would want her to not forget who she is
yes.
and take time out for herself.
And I think selfish. That's very typical for Asian parents too, isn't
that's
it?
That's very
they put
true.
So yeah. much expectation and so much hope, especially yeah. you were the only child.
Yeah. I think that's very true. And I know that I might sound like I'm being ungrateful, but honestly, like I think, I'm a firm believer in that stress causes a lot of harm inside our bodies, yeah. whether it's an indirect cause of her cancer, an indirect cause of my autoimmune condition, or a direct cause, who knows? But it was not until now, after I've dealt with all those years of illness through my mother's life and through my own, that I think there's a limit to what we're able to handle as human beings when it comes to stress. And I think we have to learn to deal with that stress in a healthy way. Mm-hmm. And everyone's threshold is different. And I think a lot of times people compare themselves to the next person and think like, how come I feel like I'm burning out, but that person's still going, but they don't really know what's going on inside that person's head or inside that person's body. And I think we need to stop kind of comparing ourselves to the people next to us and just learn to be more in tune with our own minds and our own bodies and realize like, hey, you know, I need a vacation at the end of these 6 months of really hard work, or I need this weekend to just not do anything but to just catch up on books and see my friends or have a glass of wine or whatever. And I think for my mom, I think now as an adult, getting closer to the age that she was when I last knew her, I think I feel like she was overcome by a lot of stress just with having to start her life over in a foreign country and building up that life, making the money to put me through school, to raise me right. And kind of there's a huge just, you know, cultural discrepancy between here and Vietnam. And it's hard, I'm sure, to raise a child in a foreign country and try to learn, keep your old culture, and that's the culture you know, but also bridge that gap with the new culture. And I think there was just a lot of stress for my mom. And I think I really admire her for having having all that burden on her shoulders. But I think, if anything, that's a lesson that I would learn from my mom's life. But, you know, she was a very protective parent, but she loved me to death, literally, pretty much.
Yeah.
And she was a very good cook, and I took that all for granted growing up because I thought all people ate like this in their home. Mm-hmm. And I just thought like, whatever, like this food is really good, but I'm not really thankful for it because I get it all the time and I don't really know how bad other kids have it, you know.
What kind of things did she used to make?
I mean, she made a lot of thi kho, so like
the
rice belly, yeah, with the eggs. I love that stuff.
You're gonna make me hungry.
And she made a lot of pho and bún bò Huế, so like different noodle soups. She was just a very good cook, and I miss her food a lot, which is, I think, what my lifelong endeavor is, to try to replicate the dishes that I ate growing up, because she never taught me anything, and she left me no recipes. So I had to I have to learn everything from scratch, and not having her around to teach me. So, but it's just trying to grasp onto the memories I have of my mom through the food that she fed me, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Seeing how successful you are today, what would your mom say to you now?
Oh, that's a good question. She would probably still criticize me for something like, your thi kho doesn't taste as good as mine, but I think she would be proud that I, in spite of everything that I've been through, I still finished my undergraduate degree, went on to get a master's degree, although she would probably say like, why did you get a master's in fine arts? Because that's going to make no money. My mom loved books and I had no idea, but she was always encouraging me and telling me that the only thing I was allowed to be was a doctor because they would make money and then I could take care of her when she got old. But we all know how that went. So I think she would still be proud to say like, you know what, you did what you wanted to do. At least you pursued something, you learned something, whether it was through a master's degree or at least, I think the important thing is that I'm always hungry to learn. And I think knowledge is power. And I think, you know, it may not come in the form of school. It may come in the form of life or working on a certain job or knowing certain people or traveling or whatever. But I think as human beings, we always need to be learning in order to grow. And I think in that fact, she would probably say that she'd be proud of me. But she probably would question, like, how did you win MasterChef with Pete Hall when it's not as good as mine?
So let's talk a bit about MasterChef. How did you become involved in the show? I know you mentioned something about they saw your blog, right?
That's right. The casting department of MasterChef, actually, I think what I heard was that they were, in addition to open casting calls, they do invite certain people to come and audition just to see how it goes. Mm-hmm. And of course they want characters for their show to make it interesting for ratings. And I heard that the casting department just Googled blind cook as a joke.
Really?
Because they were just like, let's just see if something comes up.
Wow.
And they found my blog. And I, at the time, I was very anonymous on my blog because I'm a very reserved person. And I really don't like to put myself out there in public, so it's kind of surprising that now I'm such a public figure.
Yes.
It's very ironic. I had no photos of myself on my blog. I did not write my real name on my blog at all. I only referred to myself as the blind cook. No photos, nothing. No one knew. I think maybe I might have written that I lived in Houston, but I wrote nothing else on my blog about who I am and what. I didn't share my blog with anyone. It really was just a personal space, and people might have accidentally found it when they were looking for certain recipes, but they found me when they Googled the blind cook or the blind cook. And then they reached out to me and said, thought it was a hoax. And they were like, oh, you want to come to an audition? And so we're casting for this show, but we're not really sure if you exist. So
quite amazing, isn't it? I think you really meant to be known and to be famous.
I mean, I guess in some ways if I really didn't want to be known or be recognized or something, I guess I wouldn't put myself online, right? I mean, I'm sure there's a part of me that I wanted to be recognized for something, not necessarily. I think I was anonymous because I kind of didn't want to deal with maybe possible ridicule or people saying like, you know, who are you? How do you, you know, you don't look blind, or how can you really cook or whatever? And I wasn't ready to deal with that. But they reached out to me and they said, we're coming to Austin, which is 2.5 hours away from my hometown of Houston. And why don't you come try out? And, you know, they said, we're part of the show called MasterChef with Gordon Ramsay. And I recognize the name Gordon Ramsay. I don't watch him on TV, but I knew that my husband, I felt like I'd heard John mention his name before. So I'd run to, I think my husband was either in the bathroom or he was in the living room, but whatever, I ran to him and I was like, hey, John, do you know who Gordon Ramsay is? And he was like, yeah, he's the guy that does like Hell's Kitchen, the angry British chef. I mean, the name was familiar. And then my husband was like, and then I told him about the email and I thought it was a joke, you know, who is this like shitty, like emailing me on my blog and like, whatever, I think this is fake. So I was like, let me just see what happens. And I replied to them and they said, oh, sure thing, come to Austin on this. And I was like, all right, well, do I do it or not? And then my husband was like, are you crazy? Just do it. Like, if anything, like, just try for it and it'll be a fun experience. We'll make a road trip to Austin. And I said, all right. And as a writer, I thought I should always experience life to the fullest because there's always room for creativity. And I think when you're in the field of creating, you always try to experience as much as you can in life because it feeds your creativity, whether it's traveling, meeting new people, trying new things, whatever. So I thought, if anything, these auditions would be something interesting to just a new experience. And maybe one day it'll show up a little bit in my fiction somewhere, right? So I was like, all right, screw it. I'm just going to like work on this dish and then go to Austin and try out. And then the rest is history.
That's an amazing story. So can you tell us some of the challenges that you experience on the show so that people have an idea? You know, I'm pretty sure MasterChef, a lot of people watch, but maybe some people haven't. So what's some of the challenges you've gone through?
So I went up against all contestants that had vision. I've been the only blind contestant and probably will only be the only blind contestant ever that they'll put on that show. So to level the playing field, they knew that I was at a huge disadvantage, not being able to see things in the pantry. So they hired someone who was acting as my aide. Her name was Cindy. I'd never met her before, but her role was to be an extension of my eyes and my legs in case I needed them. So I had to learn to communicate with her. So to level the playing field, like, for example, if like I was cooking on the stove and say I was searing a steak and I needed to know if the steak was cooked or raw or whatever, and I had to ask her very objective questions like, Cindy, is this piece of meat still red? Is it pink? Is it brown or is it black? And then she could answer. She couldn't even say like, oh, your steak is burning. Right. She can't be subjective with what she told me. So I had to learn to communicate with her. And if she had to run to the pantry, if I asked her to go get me a stand mixer and she would have to leave the station, she's an extension of me. So it's not like I could be cooking on my station because technically I'm away at the pantry getting a stand mixer. So I would just step away from my station. And even if something's like on fire on the stove, I can't do anything about it. I have to wait till she gets back to go back to touch my stove again. And we just had a bunch of different challenges, from things like mystery box, where you just open up your box and then you have to cook with something underneath it. And
I think one time you found out that it was a live crab in there, right?
Yeah. Well, actually, under my mystery box, one time I found a live sea urchin. The crab
yeah,
was
I remember that
it was
too.
A Yeah, I think the crab was like an elimination round where I was assigned a live crab.
Christine, you got a live.
I knew it. Okay, how's it wrapped up?
No, it's not wrapped.
It's not wrapped?
No.
It's just in a bowl?
It's not in a bowl. It's in your shopping cart.
So it's just moving around?
Yeah, it's just moving around. Good. Live.
Can I beat it with my cane?
Oh, God. I'm pretty scared and nervous. I do fear, I don't know where the crab's pinchers are, so I'm a little afraid that it could turn around and just get me on my hands.
Christine is working through that crab. I thought it would be more of an issue, but look at her. She's getting all the meat out, cracking it up, going with a sense of feel.
Visually stunning. Are you really blind?
Yes, Chef, I am.
What color eyes have I got?
I have no idea, Chef. I've been asking people here actually to describe all of you to me so I could figure out what you all look like.
What is that there?
I was thinking about ceviche. I kind of went for something that was like more of a cocktail with tomato juice.
It's delicious.
Oh, thank you, Chef.
It's fresh. It's fragrant. You cook every freaking time like an angel. Good job.
Thank you,
Seriously.
Chef.
Seriously. Ryan, come on. A taste. A special treat for you.
Yeah, it's really awesome. You knocked it out of the park, Christine.
Thanks. I want to prove to Ryan that you did try to screw me by giving me live crab, but I turned around and made it into something awesome.
And then got things on fire too, wasn't it? Burning corn and stuff like that.
Yeah, during a team challenge, those were always the hardest challenges for me, the field challenges, because it's already hard enough that I got used to the MasterChef kitchen. Like I had to get used to an all new station, but at least most of the time we're cooking on our own station. And I got to know that. And it's not like I had to run around an area, right? It was just, I was right in front of my station. I knew where the sink was. I knew where the oven and stoves and my utensils were. But the field challenges were a whole new ball game where I had to leave the kitchen and be put in an entirely new environment. And as I'm sure that you understand, Quinn, like when you're in a new place, you have to acclimate yourself, and that takes time and it's stressful. And I had to do that very quickly before I even started the challenge. And then we start the challenge, and then I'm trying to cook and then get all this stuff done. And there was just so many variables going on. So those were always the most stressful challenges for me, were those field challenges. And so, yes, there was one time when we had to cook outside. We had to grill a bunch of steaks and make some sides, and I was in charge of the corn, and so I threw all the stupid corn
that was so cute.
With the husks on the grill on high, and they were on fire, and I had no idea until Gordon Ramsay came over and told me that my fucking corn was on fire. And then that was that, and I had to start over.
I mean, even for me listening to the show, I don't know how contestants like you go through the process. Even just watching, it seems so stressful.
It is completely stressful. And I mean, everyone has different thresholds for stress, and everyone has different challenges when it comes to that. And for me, obviously, it was stressful because I can't see. So everything was heightened for me, I think, in that way. The stress level was heightened. Yeah. And it's stressful because the producers sequester us from our friends and family. So we stay in hotel rooms and we're not allowed to call. They take up our cell phones and our laptops, so we have no access to the outside world.
Oh, really? For how long?
It depends on how long. The whole season, I think, took about 2 months to film. Mm-hmm. You're allowed to call home every, like, 3 weeks or so, and they monitor your phone calls, and it's probably, like, a 7-minute phone call or whatever, just to, you know, let your family know that you're still alive. But everything is very hush hush, and they, you know, I think partly it's due to just wanting to keep the season and what happens a secret, of course. And then secondly, I think part of it is to kind of psychologically wear you down, and so it makes for probably more drama on television. It's because that's why my friends that know me well, when they watch the show, they were like, you are crying like every episode. And in real life, I really don't cry that much. Being secluded, going through so much stress, I think it wore a lot of us down, and so that's why we become very emotional, and it is stressful indeed for everyone in that situation.
When did you feel most discouraged?
Probably the challenge, it was a challenge where it was an elimination challenge, so we knew someone was going to go home, so there was always kind of like a heightened level of stress because we knew like someone would go home. And for me, actually, I was friends with everyone, all of my fellow contestants. So for me, it was kind of hard. It was like, I always compare MasterChef, the experience of MasterChef, to kind of like pledging a sorority or a fraternity. Yeah. Not that I'm in a sorority, or I'm in a business fraternity. So, but that's kind of different. It's not like a social Greek sorority. But I always compare it to that because I think it's like you're all of a sudden placed with a bunch of people you don't know who are very different from you, but you're forced to go through all of these things together. And after you're done, no one will ever understand what it was like except for those people that experienced it with you.
Yeah.
And so I became very close with these people very quickly because we're together like 24 hours a day, you know, we're on set together, we're go out to eat dinner together, we're in the same hotel together. I mean, we're in separate rooms, but we're spending all of our days and nights with these same contestants, and you're all kind of in it together, even though you're all trying for the one to be the number one that's left. But I became friends with everyone. So anyways, it was an elimination round, so I knew someone was going home. It was the challenge where we were divided up into teams by the winner of the previous challenge. And I was placed with Stacy, and the challenge was we had to tag team each other and make replicate a sushi dish. And I think it included like some pieces of sushi, some tempura vegetables, and like a California roll or something like that. And it was so difficult because I could not see what's going on. So when I'm standing on the sidelines and Stacy's making the stuff, I don't know what's going on. She has to narrate it to me, but of course she's not necessarily used to like describing everything she's doing while she's doing it. And then when I come in and it's my turn, I have to figure out where she left off. And Japanese cooking is not necessarily my forte either. So it was just so hard. And it was a challenge that I knew everyone was not going to do well at, but we apparently did the worst. And then when we were called in as the team that was at the bottom and I knew one of us was going home, I felt so crappy and so broken. And I wanted to just turn in my apron and let Stacy keep it and go on. But that just wasn't what happened. And they sent Stacy home. And I think I was really broken up about it. And I think that was when I just felt like I didn't know if I wanted to keep going anymore. And it's nice to be a winner, but I just felt like there was just so much compromise in like my integrity and everything that I wasn't sure if I could keep going. But part of me never gives up. And I knew that I wouldn't go home unless I went down fighting. And so I wouldn't give up. But it was, you know, it was a time when I was questioning like why I was there and what I was doing.
What helped you keep going?
I think that comes back to personality. I think I'm just very determined. I'm very, very competitive. I've always been very competitive. My friends make fun of me because when I play board games, I get really pissed when I don't win. And so I've always been a very competitive person by nature. And I think for that, that's the reason that kept me going. It's just, and I think that's what keeps me going in life as well. There's so many times when I wanted to give up on MasterChef, but and I thought, you know what, honestly, like if I were sent home that day, I would be completely okay with it. But I wasn't willing to sabotage my dishes or and I wasn't willing to perform less than my best in order to make that happen. I figured I'm going to do my very best because I'm competitive and I just can't. I'm such a perfectionist, too, and that I don't like to put anything less than what I think is stellar. So I figured, okay, if I go home today, then it was meant to be, and I'm completely fine with it because at least I know I did my best and it wasn't meant to be. But I wasn't willing to make any crappy food or like sabotage any of the challenges. And so I think that's just what kept me going. It's just
so you didn't slack off despite feeling very discouraged at times, but you still performed your best.
Yes.
How are you, Christine?
I'm all right, Chef.
Okay, first of all, I've never seen you that flustered. And then, with barely 18 minutes to go, you still were not in the oven with your apple pie. What the hell is going on?
Honestly, Chef, there's just no excuse. I just was flustered and I'm not experienced with making pie at all, so there's just really no excuse.
What do you think this pie looks like?
I think it probably looks like a pile of rubbish.
Visually, it looks stunning. It's got a nice crisp, dark brown color on the edge.
Thank you, Chef.
The sugar has almost glazed the pastry, and it looks as delicious as Frank's. So stop doubting yourself. Be bold.
Yes, chef.
Okay? Pie underneath. The pastry looks cooked. Can you hear that on top?
Yes, chef.
What does that sound like to you?
It sounds good and crusty.
Good and crusty. So, stop feeling upset with yourself. Okay? You've got to start believing yourself more. Okay? Come on. Come on. Right. Hear that?
Yes, chef.
There's not a soggy patch on there. That's all the way around. Okay? And it's intact right in front of your very eyes. I have a wedge.
Oh, thank God.
Of a beautiful apple pie. And the flavour? The flavour's amazing. Okay? It's delicious.
So, at what point did you realise there's a really big chance that I'm going to win this?
You know, probably not until I was in the final two.
Is it? Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I guess I didn't have that confidence in me, or maybe I'm just modest. I don't know. I mean, I truly just every day I was just like, oh, I don't have no idea what's going to happen. Like, I don't think I have what it takes to win this, but I'm going to still try my very best. And I'm just going to, you know, and like I said, I just had that mentality where I would go in there and do my best. And if I go home, then I go home. But I never really thought that I would win, or I never even thought I would go as far as I did. I thought the first thing was I thought I would go to these auditions in Austin and then that would be that, and I wouldn't get called back to Hollywood. And then when I went to the top 100 to Hollywood to meet the judges, I was like, oh, well, I probably won't get an apron. And then when I got an apron, I was like, oh, well, I probably won't make the top 36. And, you know, and after a while, I was like, as I kept moving on, I thought, okay, I just want to make it to the top 10 so I could say I made it to top 10. But it's so stressful that I wanted to go home after that. It didn't hit me until I think 2 days after I won that I'd won. I just was so relieved that the whole thing was just over, that I was more grateful for that than for winning. You know, I was just like, thank God I don't have to, like, I got my cell phone back and I was able to call home, and thank God that I don't have to, like, wake up at the crack of dawn or and go do some cooking that I don't know what's going on and be ridiculed and this and that. And I was just so relieved that it was over that it didn't really sink in that I'd actually won.
The fish is beautiful. It's cut perfectly. You've got the right amount of passion fruit. How do you do this?
It takes a lot of memory. Obviously, I have to use that instead of my vision. So it's about using all the other senses and just focusing.
All the components together harmonize. And it's delicious. Super proud of you being
Thank
able to
you.
Do this at this level, and good job.
Thank you so much, Chef.
I've doubted you before, and then I thought that you and I have something in common. When I taste wine, which is not so visual, I see things. And I had to think these food flavors must have the same impact on you. So when you taste the dish, images must come up in your mind, and then be able to put them back in the plate to reinterpret that mental imagery. Well, that's a pretty amazing talent to be able to do that.
I basically just tasted each element separately and then together and asked about the color and thought about what it was.
You continue to impress and amaze us. That is a great dish. Congratulations to you.
Thank you so much, sir.
You absolutely nail it. From the position of the avocado pureed, the passion fruit drizzled on the exact same area that Graham did.
Am I being punked?
No, I wish.
It's delicious.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm for the first time in this competition, to be honest, Christine, I'm lost for words. Great job.
Thank you.
You know, my husband is a really good fan of you. What's your advice for him so that to help him cook good?
My advice to people who want to improve their cooking is that you should not be afraid to make mistakes, because I make mistakes all the time still. When you cook a lot, you're bound to make a lot of mistakes, and you just learn from them. And I think that goes with life as well, is just learning from your mistakes. I think also you need to eat a lot and try everything and not be afraid of things that you might think are weird or may not taste good. You need to try everything. That really, I think, broadens your palate and helps you hone in on things you like and don't like, and different textures, flavors, cultures, whatever. So that's important. And to try everything, whether it's new restaurants, old restaurants, tried and true restaurants, other people's cooking, home cooking, whatever. And leading up to that as well is you need to travel and experience other cultures. And I think that's a good reminder of just life in general. It won't help you in just your cooking, but I think it helps you with your way of thinking and just how you live your life. I think we tend to be very ethnocentric, especially as North Americans. There's so much that you can get here already culturally. In that way, we're fortunate that we can get so many different types of food. I live in Houston. There's just so much variety here. I can go get Ethiopian food. I can get Chinese food, Vietnamese food, Filipino food, Korean food. I can get, I don't know, Indian food, whatever. But it's still different here. And it's, you're not going to be completely immersed in a culture unless you visit that country or that city or that region. And I think traveling is very important to just remind us that we're just a small part of this universe. Mm-hmm. And I think that's important to remember, and it keeps us humble. Mm-hmm. And I think those things help you become a better person, a better creator, and a better chef.
So, you know, writing and cooking, they are forms of art. And art often is really subject to a lot of critiques, some really good and some not so good. How has it been for you, you know, receiving critiques?
I will be first to admit that I probably am not that great at receiving criticism, but I'm working on that. I think fortunately I haven't, my cookbook did well. My cooking did well on MasterChef. But I do understand that when delivered in the right way, criticism from the right people that you respect is very important and really a necessity for growth. And I think if it's delivered in the right way, and not of ill intent, but it's from people you respect that are trying to help you, I think for sure I welcome that. Being in the spotlight that I've been in, I've received criticism before from people who thought I cheated my way through MasterChef, people who thought I faked my blindness, people who thought I faked my cooking. You know, at the end of the day, I am a sensitive person, and it was hard for me to kind of read what these people wrote online. But then, you know, I learned that people will say things online, especially online. It gives them a courage because they're hiding behind their computer screen and they're not saying it to my face. And people will always be bullying people online. And there was something that one of my friends told me that I think President Obama had said. And he said, what he does is he takes everything, all the good things that people say about him and all the bad things that people say about him, and he just kind of neutralizes it. And he says it's because these people don't really know me personally. And I realize that that's so true, because it was just as hard for me to take the negative criticism as it was hard for me to take all of this praise, because I wasn't used to all of this praise from people that didn't know me. And I was very afraid, because I thought if anything, people placed me kind of on this pedestal. And the only direction I had to go from there is down. And I was afraid because people thought I was this angel, this person I couldn't do any wrong. And people defended me so much from these other people that were criticizing me online. And and they said, like, no, she's like so sweet and this and that. And I'm like, you know what? Like, I'm not that sweet. I can be a downright bitch a lot of times. Yeah. And I thought, if anything, I was really concerned with people's two-dimensional views of who I was, because they thought they knew me because they watched me for, you know, 20 episodes on TV one summer or whatever. So I know I'd address this on my blog. And when I meet people in person, I am really just myself. And I think it's just good to be honest and admit that I'm full of flaws. And I think people actually relate to that. And people, I find it nice when I meet people in person that they tell me that, oh, you are actually a much cooler person than I thought you would be, or whatever, or you're a much more relatable person. And for me, that's what makes me appreciate, I think, being authentic with people. But, you know, all this criticism, it was hard for me to take the negative. But, you know, it's a process where you have to learn to let go of your pride. And I think if anything, I have learned humility with losing my vision and all that. So I'm working on it.
So what's the next chapter? What are some of your projects now?
Well, I just came off a production of, you know, a season of MasterChef Vietnam where I was a judge. That was season 3. That's airing right now in Vietnam. And I just came off also another production with Four Senses, the cooking show I have in Canada that's geared towards getting novice and vision impaired cooks in the kitchen. So I just finished the 3rd season of that as well. I'm working on my memoir, like we've discussed. Mm-hmm. And so I'm really trying to get that done and drafted for revisions. And then I'm doing, you know, some stuff here and there in Vietnam. I launched a popcorn line over there, and I'm going back in December to promote it. And we'll see. There's been a lot of talk about me mm-hmm. opening something, whether it's in Houston or in the U.S. or in Vietnam, like a restaurant or a bar. So I've been kind of toying with that idea as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Before we end here today, what would you like to say to the listeners on the show?
I would want people to know that life is definitely not easy, and I am a testament to that. Try to remember who you are, where you came from, surround yourself with good friends and family and community. I think there's always a light at the end of the tunnel. I don't want people to ever think that I'm this like awesome, magical person because I survived these challenges and I came out like smiling and really happy, but I mean, I am happy now. It took a long time to get here. It wasn't easy. And I think a lot of this will be addressed in my memoir. A lot of times also, we don't give ourselves enough credit for how much strength and will we have within ourselves. We tend to want to give up a lot. But I think when we're really put to the test, we have that capacity to survive it. But it's just a matter of finding that inner strength. And it may not be easy to find, but I really do believe that everyone has that within themselves. And a lot of times we don't recognize it. And sometimes it takes other people to tell us that or to help us find it. But I think that there's nothing in life that we really cannot handle. It just may take a long time of healing. It's possible. And I think a lot of it comes also down to attitude. What kind of an attitude do you have? When I lost my vision, I could have either given up and felt sorry for myself and be depressed, which I was depressed for some time. But at some point, I knew that life was going to keep moving on and the world was going to keep turning without me. And I could either drop out and give up or try to assimilate back into society and figure out a way to give back to society and be a part of life again. And I think that's the choice I had to do. And it was completely rewarding. And I think people need to remember that and have that sort of an attitude, like a can-do attitude.
Well, thank you so much, Christine. I've learned a lot from your story, and you're very inspiring and, you know, and just a very personable person. So I really honored to be able to talk to you today and honored to share your story with other people.
I think it's great.
Yeah. Thank you, Christine.
Yeah, it was a pleasure. We dug into a lot of stuff that I appreciate, because now I can go back to my memoir and have that fresh feeling of having talked about my feelings.
And that was Christine Ha, who is the first ever blind MasterChef winner in history. To learn more about Christine, go to her website, theblindcook.com. Join me again 2 Saturdays from now, November 28, for another very powerful show. We are going to talk about a topic that is extremely difficult and painful for men because there's a lot of shame associated with it. We'll talk about men surviving and healing from the trauma of sexual abuse. I am very honored to be able to invite 2 special guests on the show on November 28. We will have Perito Herrera, who is a survivor of severe sexual abuse and a survivor of civil war. He will share with us his incredible journey healing from the trauma of sexual abuse, learning to forgive, and also learning to make the best of his painful past. We'll also talk to Don Wright, who is the founder of British Columbia Society for Male Survivors of Sexual Abuse. For the last 30 years, Don has been a therapist, an advocate, and a trainer in the field of male survivors of sexual abuse, helping thousands of men to heal from the trauma that they experienced. So join me again 2 Saturdays from now, November 28, 9 p.m. Pacific Time. This is Quinn's Empowerment Hour with Quinle Erickson, and thank you for joining me tonight. Good night. This is Quinn's Empowerment Hour, hosted by Quinle Erickson, every other Saturday, 9 p.m. Pacific Time. For more information about Quinn, visit www.quinle.com. Thank you so much for tuning in, and you have a beautiful, restful sleep. Good night.